And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
We should just roll right into these shows because the conversations before the shows are always the best. Thanks, Claude. This is Chatter on Books. It is. I'm kind of losing track, but I think it's our 45th episode. I'm pretty happy.
It's on the paper, so it must be true.
It really doesn't, because if you look at Apple iTunes, it has a different number. But anyways,
462,
something like that. Yeah, 150,000 downloads per show. It's great.
That is awesome.
We are at our favorite undisclosed location. Michael Kornheiser is here with some anxiety issues. David Aldridge.
I'm just drinking.
Yeah.
We're going out for the 30th straight year.
And Nevin Martell, once our featured author, now back as a featured participant. Thanks
Absolutely.
For being here.
Great snacks, great company.
We can talk more about my snacks. And Claude, of course, running the board, doing everything important. When Claude's not here at 15 minutes before, I get a little nervous. Because we can do anything with anybody or nobody, but we can't do it without Claude.
Nope.
So we got some very quick randoms tonight. I got to make fun of what the New York Times and the Washington Post have come out with. They're declared best books of 2019. David, I want to ask you about the Redskins.
Ask away.
We're going to have Jeannie Safer, this amazing woman who is married to an amazing guy. She's the liberal. He's the conservative. She has the I Love You, But I Hate Your Politics book. She is the politics doctor. Fabulous. We're going to talk to Nevin about cookbooks and food and Thanksgiving disasters.
Oh, and some successes.
And some successes. And because we know Michael, who is in charge of Thanksgiving for the first time, is going to have an awesome success this Thursday.
It's going to be great.
We have page after page after page of advice for Michael from followers to this show and some other random people who just heard and wanted to weigh in. So we got lots of that. Okay, David, quickly, the Redskins, they won.
Yes, I know it's rare, but
should we be hopeful or should we just be happy they had one little...
Just enjoy the win.
The young guy, the quarterback, the
Haskins,
local guy.
Yeah.
Dwayne better, Haskins. Right?
Not really.
Ooh-ish.
No, he didn't really play all that. Well, I'll say this. He played well at the end when it was most important.
Okay.
But for the whole rest of the 57 minutes of the game,
not so good. Not so good. But he got no help.
No, he does not have any help. And that has to be considered when you evaluate him. They're terrible.
Yeah.
They're a terrible team.
Nevin, are you or were you a Redskins fan?
I am not, but I enjoy laughing at them.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is this going to do for their draft position?
My biggest worry is that they go and win
a couple games.
I don't know. I mean, they'll be top five probably. I think all of that kind of works
itself
out.
There's a team worse than them?
Oh, the Bengals are 0-11.
Wow.
Bengals are winless.
Jeez. Wow. Yeah.
And they got the tiebreaker against the Dolphins.
Right.
Are they and their owner as hated as the current team and its owner? Their owner?
The Bengals?
Yeah.
I think the Bengals, they're almost euthanized. They're just not, the fans are just like, pause up. They just don't even know what's going on. It's been that way forever. This guy who owns the team is just he literally is 1962.
You saw the photo.
Mm. Yeah.
The photo of him walking in front of the stadium was sell the team.
Sell the team?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Hope springs eternal.
I went out last week when they played the Jets at home at FedEx Field, and I walked around the parking lot literally asking people, why are you here? Seriously, why are you here?
Did you find some Redskins fans?
Yes,
or did you?
I did.
Yeah.
And it's poignant because it's almost not even about the game anymore. It's about these people that want to get together and have a drink and have some fun together because they know each other and they've known each other for years.
Yeah.
But you feel bad for them because you'd like for them to have... This guy drives... One guy I talked to, he drives every home game from Savannah, Georgia.
Eesh.
Nine hours up and 9 hours back. And he's happy to do it. It's just amazing to me.
You can point him to a couple other teams.
Yeah.
Okay, hope springs eternal. Jeff Bezos, if you're listening, we're all praying. That'd be a great Thanksgiving gift, wouldn't it?
Ooh, that'd be fun.
It'd be fabulous. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, since Jeannie's not here, I can really make fun of bestseller lists and things like that. Jean McManus loves bestseller lists. Yeah. I hate those kind of things. Worse than the bestseller list is when the New York Times and the Washington Post, as they did a couple of days ago, come out with, they just declare these the best books of 2019. So, David, why don't you pick up the New York Times one?
Pick up the New York Times.
Just flip through.
Yeah.
Michael, you flip through. See if, and just read off random titles and see if you have ever heard of any of them.
Let's see what we got here. The New York Times.
Can I guess at random titles?
Are sure, yeah.
The third one.
Hummingbird Street.
No.
Exhalation by Ted Chiang.
Never.
No.
Many of the nine deeply beautiful stories in this collection.
Keep moving. Nope. Moving on. Nope.
Micah, yeah.
Nope.
Michael, do you want to join?
I've heard of one of these.
I've heard of The Club, the Leo Damrosch book.
Okay, nobody else at this table has.
Okay.
Proving my point. Okay. So now look at your Washington Post one.
Oh, okay.
And again, it's the way in which they declare this. Well, these are the best books of 2019.
This is a group of one percenters.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, come on.
A lot of MFAs.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean.
Never heard of them, right?
Never.
I've never heard of any of these, but I recognize the covers just by leafing through the New Yorker.
Ah, there you go.
Okay. All right. So you can put those down. So those were making me angry for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. And so then right before, a couple hours ago when I was panicking, is Claude going to be here? Because he's the only important one. I got this thing. I think it was from our buddy Ron Charles. Do you know Ron Charles?
I do not.
Book critic for the Washington Post. Fabulous guy. The Washington Independent Review folks came out with their 51 favorite books of 2019. Mm-hmm. This is not what they arrogantly declared the best books.
No, no.
These are our favorite books.
Yes,
so I started flipping through these going, okay, these are books we've heard of. Black Leopard, Red Wolf.
Right. Somebody might actually read.
Somebody might actually read. Then I was really happy, and I don't know where they came up with the number 51, but I was really happy because then I started to see Miracle Creek by Angie Kim.
Oh, how about that?
It's been on this show.
Very good.
Fabulous book. Great person.
Yes.
Courting Mr. Lincoln, Lewis Bayard. Do you know Lewis?
I don't. No.
Fabulous guy.
My wife's reading Miracle Creek right now, so I'm excited.
Miracle Creek is great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Soon to be a great series somewhere. And then you keep going. And there were a few that were also on the list from the New York Times and the Washington Post. And then Girl, Woman, Other, which the only reason I know of that is Ron Charles raved about it, said everybody should read it. It's a novel by Bernardino Evaristo. It co-won one of the big prizes with Margaret Atwood, The Testaments.
And okay.
Ron Charles said, written in verse, right? Yeah, yeah. And he said, forget that, read this one.
Okay.
So there's that. Wow. And then also on this list, Betrayal in Berlin, Steve Vogel's book.
Oh, wow.
So I think we are in keeping. So that's three of our authors are on this list.
They must listen.
Yeah. So this is a wonderful list.
Yes.
The other ones suck. Okay, so Nevin, we're going to shift. I want to set the mood here, and we're going to shift to you and talk about food and cookbooks.
Let's do it.
Of the many, many, many tweets, Facebook, whatever it's called, emails that we got.
Screen grabs of your DMs.
Screen grabs. Yeah. Wait, here's my favorite one, which is going to set the context for Michael being in charge this week. Michael, you can guess who this is from. I've cooked our family turkey dinner for at least 45 years. I'm thrilled to pass the turkey tradition to Michael.
So this is clearly from my mother. And for the record, over the last 15 years, they've eaten out on Thanksgiving. Well, so let's count them up.
You should probably just pick up the bill and take them out then.
Yeah.
All right, Nevin, it is great to see you again.
Happy to be here. This
foodie,
is exciting.
Foodie, photographer, travel, chronicler of Watterson.
Check, check, check.
Father of Calvin and Hobbes.
Love it.
Writer of these amazing cookbooks, and I'm really familiar with Red Truck Bakery and the cookbook and that whole scene, and You Can't Leave Me Alone with a Bag of Their Granola, because I will mainline it.
Best granola ever.
It's one of the best eating experiences ever.
I mean, it's all sugar, all love, but yes.
Works for me.
Yeah.
And then Founding Farmers Cookbook.
Yeah, which, I brought this because second edition just came out a couple months ago, and there are a number of recipes in it that are just fantastic for the holidays. The skillet cornbread, which you then turn into this fantastic cornbread stuffing. There's a Brussels sprouts recipe tossed with Worcestershire and bacon, of course. There's a nice light spritzer.
Is there anything that's not made better than with bacon?
You know,
anything?
I haven't found it yet. Though, actually, someone did give me a tube of bacon lube once as a joke. I have not opened up said tube. I think lube is better without bacon. But this has all sorts of fun recipes that I consider like kind of classics around the holiday. And actually, I'm going to pass this on to you. So when you have a chance and you want to do some baking and cooking, you can tackle them yourself.
Is it okay if I pass that on to the bartender?
Slide it around.
Okay, but let's back up. So you wrote, it's a wonderful book about Bill Watterson, the creator of Calvin and Hobbes. Mm-hmm. You wrote that book pretty much start to finish in kind of the classic sense of writing.
Yep.
What's the difference between writing a book like that and writing cookbooks?
There's much better catering on a cookbook job. you know, with Calvin and Hobbes, I'm sitting in my basement, you know, running upstairs for Nespresso. Founding Farmers, Red Truck Bakery, you're sitting in the middle of the eatery. And, you know, at some point, someone will come around and be like, so what can we get you?
Nice.
And, we're working on this thing. Let's try it. It's vastly different, too, in the sense that this is very punchy, short writing, with the exception of the opening essay. All the pieces are, you know, a paragraph or two long. Whereas writing Calvin and Hobbes, you know, it's a long narrative.
It's a real book.
And it's a real book, yeah. And was written in 3.5 months, whereas Calvin and Hobbes was a year.
Who decides which recipes you're going to include?
Mm-hmm. It's well, that's a hearty argument. Founding Farmers, they had already signed the book deal when I came on, so they had already discussed it with the publisher, and I was much more hands-on with Red Truck because I took that from pitch and proposal through the publication. It's a lot of back and forth because, you know, for every recipe that you think is so near and dear to your heart, it just might have too many ingredients that are
kind of close
to kill something else somewhere else sometimes. In the book. And, yeah. You know, you can only have two chocolate recipes, and there were five chocolate recipes to start. So where do you get rid of three, and then what do you replace the three with? And it's a lot of horse trading, and editors actually play a huge role in that because they're very opinionated people. Mm-hmm.
Shocking that.
And which is great. You want to have a book that has diversity so readers can, of all different types can, you know, have something to make and something to look forward to. But it is a lot of horse trading. And then a lot of aggravation, because when you think you have 100 recipes, you suddenly have 65, and then you're like,
what happened?
Where are we going to come up with the other 35?
So, Michael, all kidding aside, you're a very good cook, and you're a very active cook. Do you use cookbooks?
I do, but not exclusively. I'd say right now it's a lot easier to digest some of these techniques and recipes through Instagram. But it really translates to the same short, impactful writing becomes that quick sort of how to that opens up an Instagram video. But there is nothing like sitting down to a beautiful cookbook and getting lost in, and it's more aspirational as to what do I want to cook next, not how am I going to get dinner on the table tonight.
Right. Gotcha. So I have an idea for a show.
Yes.
It's like Podcast Beyond. So, you know, Peloton, you can do the on demand class or you can do them live. So there's a person in a studio on the bike leading the class or people in the class, and you can go along live, right? And you're watching it on this very slick computer screen. So a chef is in a kitchen, like right there, doing, cooking a meal or cooking a dish live, and you cook along in your home. And maybe a few days before you got the menu, or you got the list of ingredients, these kinds of things, and you cook along.
It might be an Amazon Alexa commercial, but there's a very powerful one where the young woman is getting ready for a date.
And she makes
and the dad just has the great closing line of like, what's his name? Which is like, bye, dad.
Yeah. You know, this is name funny. Is Sam. Because I've watched the commercial.
Walker is almost 2.5, and he loves cooking with me. So he has he has his own
little
kitchenette.
That'd be good till the hot oil falls on his face.
He takes all the nice trivets and brings them over to his. Yeah, thanks, Dave.
It's like turning him into Two-Face.
But we set up his high chair in the kitchen, and if I'm making, say, vegetable soup and I'm chopping, you know, I'm getting my mirepoix ready, he's gnawing on some carrots and weighing out the celery, trying out the onion, and then he's like, ah, slimy. But no, that'd be a lot of fun to try and follow along with somebody.
Yeah, they'd have to be pretty simple.
Yeah.
But I think it'd be a blast. Okay.
But some of the simplest stuff, like watching someone who really knows how to finish and sear a steak in a cast iron skillet. That's something that a lot of people are very intimidated by, and it takes no time at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Favorite thing from cookbooks? Is it the main course, or is it side dishes that you look for?
For me, it's all about the main, and I want it to be more complicated in looks than it actually is. So even like recently we did a beef barbacoa dish. Couldn't have been easier to make if you just sort of understood the process and the flavor profiles you wanted to. And it's just like simple things with finishing touches that you probably already have, like various acids.
Mm-hmm.
But there's that really powerful book that was also the Netflix series, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat.
Yep.
But just understanding some of those simple components goes a long way.
So, Nevin, when you're doing these cookbooks, are there also fights about the recipes themselves? And the reason I say that is I honestly can't remember who it was, but this was years ago, some famous chef. I'm sure this was before hashtag Me Too, so he's probably in jail now. But some famous chef talking about working on a cookbook, and he thought it was hilarious because they insisted that he come up with precise measurements for everything. A teaspoon of this, half a cup of that, and he laughed and goes, I never do that. I just do, right?
Right.
So I kind of know Brian Noyes from Red Truck Bakery. I can't speak to the Founding Farmers, but they're not in the kitchens at these places using precise measurements, are they?
They're definitely not, and also they're making it at such scale that when they then make it for the home chef, they have to downsize it, and then they also have to take out all the ingredients that you probably can't get at your local grocery store.
Such as?
You know, I mean, for example, in Brian's cookbook, he cooks with a lot of sorghum, which is available widely through the South, but like if you pass
thought
the Mason
that was
Dixon
Little House
line,
on the Prairie,
well,
but okay.
I mean, here in DC, you can get it, but beyond that, you can't really get it. So, you know, you have to give people an alternative for things that they can find. So we use it often maple syrup or molasses, depending on the application. But you know, like you can't call for like a very specific kind of sea salt. You know, it's sea salt is fine. You know, it's like you can't call for a particular brand of olive oil. Extra virgin olive oil is fine. You know, a lot of chefs, they prize like the micro notes of a recipe. And, you know, to be honest, you can definitely taste it when you're in the restaurant. But at home, for someone trying to remake that recipe, especially given what they have in terms of the equipment in the kitchen and the skill set usually of a home cook, you just give them the most basic version of the ingredients. And to be honest, too, chefs often leave out an ingredient or two.
Just to screw with you.
No, that they make, they feel makes the recipe special or is like some sort of proprietary element of that they don't want to like share with other chefs. I mean, some chefs are very open. And to be fair with both these cookbooks, that was not the case. These are very true to the taste that you'll have in the restaurant. But you know, I've worked with a lot of other chef for stories and I know that they've left out certain elements and techniques because I've seen them
very
make it.
Basic can be super complicated as well. If you even, for example, if you're talking about how much you salt and someone says, I want it to taste like the briny, salty, briny, salty water. And you're looking at them like, oh my gosh, look at all that salt. But you realize they're using diamond salt versus
what
sort
the heck
of the
is diamond salt?
Kosher salt.
Well, David and I are hearing words we've never heard. Claude, have you heard any of these words? There was one that started with a B that was like, what is diamond salt?
It's crystal size. You know, there's different big size salt. Crystals to salt.
So you're basically
don't
using
pretend
twice
like you
as
know
much salt
in
the same salinity.
Wow, where do you go for your different salts? Where do you find them, Michael?
Well, you know, are we going to get into Maldon salt right now?
Love Maldon sea salt.
Oh, you should have seen the looks on their two faces.
My God, no,
would
I
the
mean,
two
like,
of you like us to leave the room?
They literally sell a 5-pound bucket of this stuff, which I wish I could buy. But my wife, our pantry is already stocked full. But I mean,
so the worst is when you're if let's say I'm slicing steak for guests, and someone reaches onto the cutting board to get that nice fatty cap end piece right before you just
chop
give
their
a
little
pinch
finger off with
of
your
the,
knife?
Of the finishing salt.
Wow.
Yeah. You should have
there
a couple
are,
of
there are layers.
On
there are layers.
You should have sea salt on
No, they're ruling it's this great. Out. We have sea salt, but it still comes in the blue box kind of thing, right? The blue, but the rule in this house is there's never too much salt. There's never too much bacon.
Fair. Well, I like your house.
Good rules.
Yeah, we can live by that forever. Okay. So as I said, this is the Michael show because there are now thousands of people who are worried about your Thanksgiving dinner. And you might need
included.
You might need to FaceTime live a little or something on Thursday because the demand is going to be pretty high.
It could be a
you might, right? Just a little. Or I can still send Claire over to your house and she'll do it because Claire Natola will do that for you, right? So we have several readings here and I'm going to get Nevin and David to help me with this. But so the first piece of advice I got was from Susan Holt, you know Nevin, from Culinary, which is fabulous, it's a cooking school, it's an event space.
And an event space, they throw fabulous events.
Yeah, really, really fabulous events. And if you're interested in anything, any particular kind of cooking, learning how to use a knife, just drinking a lot of good wine, you go down to that cooking school and you just have a blast. And it's a ton of fun. We've known her for 1,000 years. And I said, hey, real quick, have any quick advice for Michael? Well, 3 pages later in the email.
Wow.
So
that's love.
Yeah, it's first love. But her number one was buy the pies. That's in caps, all caps. Right? Who's ever hungry for dessert? So why slave over pâté brisé? Nevin, what is pâté brisé?
It is a type of dough that is traditionally used for crust.
Oh, you people with your words. Okay.
And actually, I took a fantastic pastry class with her and I learned pâté brisé with her.
The Great British Baking Show.
I watched Top Chef. Is that the same thing?
Chopped.
No. Chopped. They don't know anything about desserts for the most part.
Chopped. Everyone on Chopped is neurotic. Everyone. Number two, let the darn bird rest.
Agreed.
Uncovered at room temperature for at least half the time you cooked that. Now, Devin,
that's a long time because like some people roast their turkeys in an older oven for 4+ hours, depending on the size of the bird, if not longer. So,
okay, she says, after the requisite cooking time, 12 minutes per pound at 400 degrees.
Some people do it really low, really.
No basting, no turning, no opening the oven door. No. The juices in the chicken have become very hot and have pushed their way to the surface. Allowing the bird to rest means the juices recede, becoming absorbed in the meat again. And more importantly, the hot juices finish the cooking process at the center of the bird. And then she goes on at length and saying, if this is too much for you, you can stick it back in the oven, back in the oven to warm it up.
The one thing I would say about, opening up the door is like, I always shellac mine with duck fat near the end.
Shellac?
Yeah. Just slap it on and it gives it a nice, I mean, it's already going to be nice and gold, but it'll really take up the level of the gold and it'll give it a nice crispy skin.
Okay. We'll come back to duck fat. do you subscribe to the don't look at it, don't touch it
I mean, I look at it with the light on, but I don't open the door.
Okay.
You know, if I feel like the top's like getting a little too crispy, I will tent it with aluminum foil, especially the wings and stuff.
Where do you get your duck fat?
So I have chef friends. Like, it was funny, like a couple years ago.
Of course. Everybody's got a guy.
Like a couple years ago, I actually put up a post on Facebook because I was like, I wanted to do the turkey this way. I was like, where can I get duck fat? And this nice guy who owned a restaurant called Coco Sala, which is no longer open, was like, you know what? Come to the restaurant and I'll give you some. And I still have.
Did you have to come to the back door?
No, he let me walk through the front, but he gave me a 5-pound tub of duck fat.
Oh my God.
Where do you store that?
In my freezer, and I still have about 2.5 pounds of it.
This is why Neva's marriage is in trouble.
No, my wife loves it. She was like, do you know how much this costs on the open market? You know, like, she was like, this is a great steal.
If you've ever finished roasted potatoes with a little bit of duck fat.
Oh, my God.
I don't think
or duck popcorn fat's... You should fry popcorn kernels in duck fat so they pop in the
we'll
duck fat.
We'll get to frying. Could you hand this to amazing. David, please? I'm going to have David do a reading from Ed Butt, who's a big...
Just to answer your question, you can get duck fat at a lot of butchers and specialty markets. Like if you go to Stokowski's in Georgetown or the market at Centralina or something like that.
You're going to the back door.
Dean and DeLuca, I'm sure, has it. Like Balducci's. You can get it at all those kind of places. Yeah.
Wow.
So, David,
yes.
Ed, who's a big fan of this show, huge fan of Tony's show, was very concerned about Michael's wine parents.
Correct.
And he sent me a separate email that says, I know Michael thinks he knows what he's talking about with wine, but let me send another email about the parents.
Yes.
It's a few pages long. Can you kind of paraphrase?
I'm trying to synthesize this, but there's a lot of big words here. A big red would overpower most of the food. Mm-hmm. A big buttery Chardonnay, which I personally don't like, just emphasizes the fat. Hmm. People are prejudiced against Riesling because of the sweet junk we drank in college.
Good prejudice.
But a dry Riesling has the acid to cut the fat, but the fruit to play with the cranberries. A more universally acceptable alternative is an un-oaked Chardonnay. Hmm. For a red, go with an Oregon or a New Zealand Pinot Noir. Lean, acidic, but fruit flavors. Most California Pinots are too heavy and fruity. Hmm. Quality Chianti works well, too. Parenthetically, that is also the favorite drink of the doctor in Silence of the Lambs. Or stay in the inheritance and go for a Brunello Chianti on steroids. My personal go-to, however, is a dry rosé. Checks all the boxes.
So this is very helpful, and I'll take that list home.
Michael comes home with a box.
Oh, I love all this. My wonderful wife, I will add, was like, can't your dad just bring wine because in full disclosure, we have him subscribe to a wine delivery system that we are paying for. So we sort of want to see the fruits of that labor. We want to open up some of those bottles. But this is actually a good question for all of you in terms of taking your guests' taste into account versus, say, I know what might pair well as you look at that with, you know, your first course with the actual turkey. But what if, say, one of my guests, my dad, really is just he's a Pinot guy and doesn't want to necessarily veer out of that lane. So do you bow to that to try and please the guest?
Let me go to page 35 of the tweets like and whatever.
Yeah.
Betsy Oilman Jaffe. I hope I'm doing that right. Know thy audience. Thanksgiving is deeply steeped in food traditions. If your diners are not adventurous, don't attempt to shake things up with sweet potato gnocchi sauteed in truffle butter or duck fat, I'm sure.
Come on, that sounds good.
And then she says something about don't be a snob. Don't shame people for their eating. It's rude and makes for boring banter. Be gracious about accommodating vegetarians, gluten-free eaters, etc. by having options. And essentially says don't take yourself too seriously.
Agree with all of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on stuffing?
Nevin?
I love stuffing.
Savory stuffing?
I love savory stuffing, yes. But I mean, if it's made with like a cornbread base or something like that, so there's a little bit of sweetness, I think that's great, if that's what you're asking. We talked about this beforehand, obviously, cooked outside the bird. There are certain people.
Hundreds of years people cooked it inside the bird.
Yeah.
And by the way, who was the first person who thought that was a good idea?
Just think about all the people that used to drink water out of lead pipes. They all did it. It wasn't a good idea.
Okay. That we didn't know. And that was something that the government provided. Yeah. So we foolishly thought, okay, that will be fine.
Man, that was
think about it. You got this bird with this big cavity in the middle. And did somebody say, oh, there's not enough room on the stovetop? Let's shove it in the bird?
Stovetop. It was a rock that they heated up.
Well, or they bury it.
I got one rock. Yeah. That's all I got.
So I guess the one thing I would say is there's the whole debate whether you put some kind of meat or protein inside the stuffing or not.
Like that
some
was people, my next question. So okay. I grew up with a savory stuffing that my mother would cook down, you know, your run-of-the-mill, probably a Jimmy Dean or Johnsonville savory
like a pork
stuffing.
Sausage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when I when I started going to my in-laws for Thanksgiving every year, I was like, I want savory stuffing.
Sure.
And I had to start slowly. So I had to make my own stuffing on the side, and slowly people started putting the spoon into my stuffing.
Yeah, nice. And you did a classic style, like Pepperidge, bag of Pepperidge Farm and classic. A Jimmy Dean roll.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I think that's great. I mean, or, you know, people get a little fancy sometimes. They put oysters in instead for the protein.
I like oysters. I've never been a fan of that.
To be honest, I like it, but it is pretty divisive at the Thanksgiving table. And then there's the whole question of whether you put a protein in or not, because oftentimes that's something that vegetarians can eat. And then you're taking a dish away from them at the table. Right. It just depends on what the makeup of your table is. If you have mostly meat eaters or all meat eaters, then it's not an issue.
And it depends on if, say, half your audience is really looking forward to leftovers, and they might like it really as just a vehicle for more turkey, potatoes, gravy, cranberries.
Yep.
And then maybe you want to have your savory sausage one as well, mm-hmm. in addition to a drier, just a very good leftover one.
Mm-hmm.
So have you set the table yet?
I have not. This is my big shortcoming. I feel very good about the cook. I feel very good about the actual food, except for, I'll tell you my turkey story from today. But I come to our undisclosed location, and all season long, you have a rotating centerpiece. And right now, our table is dominated by Richard Scarry Busy Town books. And so we're trying to time it so that both boys can be with us at the table.
Mm-hmm.
So candles are out.
Mm-hmm.
Not really sure what I should do for a centerpiece other than just...
You can take the little mini gourds home.
Well, you know what? My grandfather used to put those old commemorative wild turkey bottles at the center of the table, the ones that he'd drunk from the year before, and he had a collection of probably 25 or 30. And then us kids had to go out and get pine cones and little sprigs of this and a little leaf of that and some branches.
I like that.
And make a little natural thing at the center of the table. It was
a little
nice.
Harder in Glover Park, a little harder to gather.
You can send them out into Rock Creek, take a little trip, walk to pre-burn off some of that.
Put some leaves down the middle.
Leaves.
Okay, yeah. I'm going to ask David to read this one because story about your turkey. Yeah. We'll let Nevin do this one. Lynn Reek, I think it is.
All right. This story took place many years ago when I was a baby. I had a great aunt, Blanche, who was such a character.
Of course,
she couldn't cook
like
to save her life, but she was going to cook Thanksgiving dinner for the family. When it came time to eat, the fam noticed the turkey, along with the rest of the meal, tasted odd, but ate it anyway, thinking it was just Aunt Blanche's cooking. Long story short, everyone ended up in the ER with food poisoning. Aunt Blanche had been cooking the bird for a week.
No.
She left it in the oven and would cook it for a bit each day when she came home from work. Thank God no one died, but after that, Aunt Blanche was only allowed to host holidays, no cooking. We could never figure out how Uncle Snappy lived as long as he did.
She'd been planning
Uncle
that
Snappy.
Trick for months.
Aunt Blanche, man, they're a story.
So
you're saying
the show,
I should take the bird out of the oven tonight?
Correct.
Yeah, I was waiting to par cook it.
Yeah, you're doing it in 15-minute increments? Oh, yeah, that's widely accepted methodology.
Again, this is all I heard before the show, Michael saying a little bit of a smell is okay, right?
Yeah.
So, Michael, where has your turkey been and for how long?
So, Miss McManus has been giving me turkey advice as to when to buy the turkey, mm-hmm. what size to buy, fresh versus frozen. Mm-hmm. So, I go to the grocery store every single day. I just sort of like walking through the store, checking
Trader
on
Joe's
the aisles.
Now, since your Whole Foods is gone?
So, I went to a different Whole Foods today just because I sort of go in between the show in the morning and mm-hmm. picking up the boy in the afternoon. And there's nothing more enjoyable than walking up and down with the retired crowd. I'm stopping. I'm giving advice on recipes.
I find them really
people.
Obnoxious myself.
Oh,
so.
I love it. I'm
Are they giving
them
you
reach.
Advice on your hip?
Oh, yeah. So I go and I get my fresh young turkey. I'm going for, there's only six of us, so 13 and a half pounder. I'm looking forward to getting some salt on that, try and get in mm-hmm. the fridge. I want to let that salt penetrate for about 2.5 days, take mm-hmm. it out so I can get it up closer to room temp so it'll be ready to roast evenly.
I'm sorry. When did you take it out for room temperature?
No. Day of, before
oh, okay.
you put it into the oven.
Okay.
Trust me, it went from the cooler at the store.
Mm-hmm.
15 minutes later, it's in the fridge in my house.
Okay.
It comes out of the bag. Ooh, that was a foul
smell. F-O-W-L or F-O-U-L?
So the worst thing you can ever do is start Googling a couple days before Thanksgiving. Yeah. Yeah. What does turkey smell like? How much barnyard is too much barnyard? And so I clean the turkey. I rinse it out. I'm opening the back door, and I my sister, the chef, I have her on the phone. She's like, did you have to open a window? Because that's usually a bad smell. I'm like, well, I did, but it was just a very concentrated smell from a little bit of the juice in the bag. The actual meat, I got into the
You separated the bag from the meat.
I'm getting under the skin to rub the salt in. The actual bird smells fine.
Yeah. Okay.
The neck was a little gamier, and I was going to use the neck to start building a sturdier stock for day of gravy and the like.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The smell in the bird in the fridge, totally fine. I think it's good, but I had that memory of cutting into the bag and just being assaulted. And of course, I'm wondering, should I throw the bird out? Should I just go get a frozen bird?
Smell and assault are not three good things to have in one.
Well, I think you're fine. Knock on wood. Please don't sue me if you're not. But I mean, it's really just the neck that smells like it does have like an earthier, gamier smell to it, like a funky smell to it, which is, that's fine. And if you wash the bird and the bird doesn't smell anymore, there are some weird juices that leak out.
Are we supposed to wash the birds? You believe in washing the birds?
You can. You know, people have different feelings about it. I mean, you got a fresh bird and never frozen.
You got a fresh young bird.
Yeah. I mean, you can. You know, it's some people like to spray out the cavity, too, before they add aromatics or before they spice it or salt it or whatever. It's really a matter of preference. You know, I think in this instance, it was probably a smart move to wash it just, you know, for peace of mind more than anything
else. I got
very
sad because one of the little wings was chipped off.
Well, he's a fighter.
A little talon.
Yeah. Your own little gladiator.
So I'll be sticking to stuffing on Thursday.
You're going to tell the kids, you go first. Yeah. You go first.
Okay, Thomas Humphrey says Popeye's Cajun fried turkey. Done it for 20 years. We'll never go back. It's just a backup plan.
People have said that to me several times this year. Like, it has a strong, strong following.
It does.
And fried turkey is a big thing.
And it's very inexpensive.
Like, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so for years and years and years, we cook one turkey in the oven and then deep fat fry one. Nice. Deep fat frying, there is nothing like it.
And there's nothing better than watching the local news.
Yeah.
That
evening. The inevitable explosion.
Remind me how to pronounce this, David. Todd Takei. He loves that you know how to pronounce his name. He's like George Takei.
Takei.
Okay.
George
Takei. Todd Takei. I'm not sure if he's like, deep frying is the best turkey. It's easy to do if you make sure the turkey is thawed and towel dried before frying. Mm-hmm. Or don't do what people do every year, which is they take a frozen turkey
and drop it in
the 500-degree peanut oil.
Yeah, there's so many things wrong with it. Yeah, that's everything wrong
don't
in
understand
once.
Volume.
Yeah. Greg Dobbs, for some reason at 23, he was put in charge of cooking the turkey for his siblings and significant others. It didn't end well. Turns out you don't cook a turkey breast side down. Who knew?
Most people. That's who knows.
Okay, well, most people don't know. Deep fried turkey. A lot of deep fried turkey.
Oh, sure.
So, Michael, we'll be using the deep fat fryer out in Sperryville. We've got one here if you want to back up.
I'll let you know if I need to come pick it up.
Yeah. The peanut oil costs a fortune. You need gallons of it.
I think medium rare has always done free deep frying on Thanksgiving.
Oh, really?
What do you go buy and
You just go stand in line. I don't know what the rules are, but they've been doing it for years.
Okay.
So free deep frying.
Wow.
That's awesome.
So
again, Betsy went on for pages and pages. I just can't do that. Then Al Poole, my father would cook the turkey on charcoal grill and it was delicious. Mm. One year at my grandparents' house and my dad was cooking the turkey on the grill again, but my grandfather didn't think the fire was hot enough.
Oh.
So he would add lighter fluid to get the fire up again.
Now that's a gravy.
Yeah.
See, I've wanted to do a smoked turkey when I go to my in-laws because I have a big green egg.
Ooh,
and at the very least, I would have done an extra breast to save for some leftovers just to try.
Ooh. Yeah, or a roast, and I'll send my dad over so he could have the roast. You can do that.
Standing rib roast?
Yeah. Okay, so Betsy, who did go on for pages, God bless
her.
Label your serving dishes and serving utensils in advance to make sure you have what you need. She uses Post-it notes. Hmm. Yeah. Choreography down, create a day, minute-by-minute document for food prep.
So my wife keeps right asking, up your alley. She keeps asking me, do you have a plan for this? I'm like, no.
Yeah.
I'm going to go, I've got various... It's all in my mind. I've got different stores for different pieces of the dinner. And she's very quick to just writing this all down because she doesn't trust me.
Well, I think if you can keep it all straight in your mind, God
yeah.
bless you.
Yeah.
I write it all down myself. I have an organizational
chart. We delegate. Everybody who shows up has to do something. There's a list of things that need to be done.
Yep.
And everybody just has to pick one and do it. Mm-hmm. And then so you lower your standards.
If you're assigning tasks, let's say someone like, I don't know, my dad was coming to your house. What would his task be?
Dishes.
Oh, I don't trust him with
pouring
my dishes.
Johnny Walker Blue, yeah. of course.
Yeah. yeah. yeah I'd put him on the liquor patrol.
Bartender.
Yeah, yeah. he can do that. David, yeah. Thanksgiving what? Tradition? You cook? Somebody else cook?
No, I told you. We've gone out since 1987. We go out.
You remember the year.
Where do you go? No, we used to. My mom passed away in 1986, and nobody felt like cooking the next year, which I totally understood. So my dad said, you know, I always wanted to try the Thanksgiving dinner over at Hogate's.
Oh, right.
Down on the wharf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we did that until Hogate's closed. Now we're going to Carmine's. That's what we do. Wow.
I think that's great, though.
Is it an Italian-American spread at Carmine's, or do they do it straight up?
They make a turkey. They give you it's an enormous bird.
Well, of course it is. It's Carmine's.
It's huge. The portions are just insanely big and too big, actually.
Yeah.
But so everybody has, literally, everybody takes a duffel bag home of leftovers. It's insane.
Mission accomplished.
But that's what we've done for two decades.
But that's nice. Yeah. That's what you do. That's what you do.
I don't mind. I really don't mind. It makes my dad happy. That's fine with me.
Yeah.
Tori, what time do you guys eat?
Usually 4:35-ish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got to have some snacks during the day, goof around outside,
see,
that kind of thing.
Bad.
Oh, you have to have something or else you just get so hungry.
Nevin, how'd you like your snacks tonight?
The snacks have been delicious.
Did you like the sweet potato one or the cranberry brie one better?
So I'm not really a big fan of the whole sweet potato souffle casserole.
Marshmallows, whatever. Not up your alley?
No. In a s'more, yes. Yeah. In my side dish, no. But the cranberry and brie with the rosemary was delicious. I had, I think, six
Michael,
of those.
What'd you like?
I was a big fan of the brie little starters.
Oh, and I didn't do Calvert Woodley. Oh, my gosh. Oh. And best wishes for Michael Sands and his family going through a lot this week. But I was over there on Friday. I went on Friday because today is the busiest day of the year for Calvert Woodley.
Oh, sure.
Wow.
No, sure.
4339 Connecticut Avenue. Very, very busy. Parking at a premium.
Oh, yeah.
The guy who
yeah.
runs the little parking lot there was losing his mind even on Friday. But because it was one of our favorites, we got the Exopto. David and I have been drinking the Exopto. What do you think, David? Pretty good, huh?
Model.
Yeah. 2017 was fantastic. Good. This is the 18. Pretty darn good. And then, are you into cheese, Nevin?
I am.
Did you have any of the cheese of the week from Calvert Woodley?
What did you miss?
I had something, yes, and it was delicious.
Michael likes it. I know it's Campo de Montalban. It's Spanish, and Ibrahim at La Cheeseria is very. He loves talking about this because it's from three different milks. It's from a cow, it's from a goat, and it's from a sheep. And he for some reason thinks this is very good, but it's really
like
good.
Holy Trinity cheese.
Yeah, it is Holy Trinity cheese. You could eat it forever. But if you go Nationals 5, you go to Calvert Woodley, and God help you if you go there on Monday because the crowds will be insane.
Yeah.
And you go there today, tomorrow, the crowds will be insane.
And pick up that triple, what was it, that brie, the blue brie they had a couple weeks back? Fantastic.
Yeah. And I say this all the time.
And Sandy's going to be in town this week.
Yeah. But everybody who works in the store knows the wine. They know the cheese.
Yeah.
And you pick up any bottle of wine, which they've told you about. You say, this is what we're looking for. They've got it. And then you walk over to La Cheeserie and the guys look at it. Oh, yeah. Go off and come back with something spectacular. So if you go there and use Nationals 5, so that is great. So Jeannie Saver, psychotherapist, the politics doctor, as many, many people call you these days, and the author of the very timely I Love You, But I Hate Your Politics. There is no better time than Thanksgiving.
Your politics.
Yeah. So by way of background, just very quickly, I know so much about you, but by way of background, explain how you became the politics doctor.
Well, I didn't seek it out. Now, Rick and I have been writing. My husband is a senior editor of National Review since, he was 25 when he got, when we married. And I think he was already senior editor, and now he's going to be 65. So do the math. He's been there a long time.
And you became you became friends with many of his colleagues at National Review.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the way this happened is Rick and I met in a real New York way. We were both members of a group that sings Renaissance religious music on street corners. How's that for us?
That's a small group. That's a small group. The chances of finding somebody in that small group.
Well, they're still around, and we still sing with them on occasion, usually at Christmas. But politics had nothing to do with it. So I had hardly known any Republicans, let alone conservatives. You know, we all live in our separate worlds, even 40 years ago we did, but now that's a whole other story. But so he had a wonderful voice, and he had beautiful blue eyes, and he was 6'4", and I'm 5 feet tall. And
perfect.
So I said, oh, well, what do you do for a living? And he said, I'm a writer. I said, oh, this sounds good. And I said, oh, who do you work for? And he said, William F. Buckley Jr. I thought, all right, I'm in for it now. But I thought, okay, 1 out of 2 ain't bad. And little did I know that all this time later, we got married in 1980, and we've been writing about this because we're considered like such an anomaly. Hmm.
That you can transcend your politics. So why is that? Why is it that so many people, seemingly smart, reasonable, rational people who are totally in love with one another, go nuts over politics? Why is that? Why is it politics that drives couples crazy?
Well, I think that religion has been taken over by politics. Mm-hmm. You know, now the main basic thing that people disagree about is who they're going to vote for, whether they're Republicans or Democrats or progressives or this or that. You know, mm-hmm. There's plenty of that stuff even within each party, but it has really. This is the new religion, and it's amazing. I mean, I have some amazing, like disturbing statistics. People don't feel that they don't want their children to go out with somebody in the other party. They would rather have them marry somebody of a different religion or race. Now that's okay. But the fact that the party is, and it's unbelievable.
Yeah. It really is. So you interviewed 50 people for this book. I Love You, But yeah. I Hate Your Politics.
And all kinds of different, personal relationships.
Right.
Parents and children, siblings, lovers of all sexes, all kinds of people.
Talk about Harry and Alan, who I think might have been one of my favorite stories in your book, and they represented one of your core principles. They are a hoot. But tell us why.
And also, you know, I have a podcast of called "I Love You, But I Hate Your Politics" that you can hear Harry and Alan have a fight. Which is a model for us all. I can't remember which is which now, but one was really tall and one was really short. I think the short one was the really conservative guy, and one of them is about 80 and the other's in his mid 70s, and they're good friends. They've been friends. They're both widowers now, but they were friends with their wives for many, many years, and they just started one night having a political conversation, and they decided it was a hell of a lot of fun. They have totally different politics. They meet in various bars. They have a drink or two, and they argue.
Good for them.
But they respect each other. It's remarkable. They had an argument right in my office because, you know, for the podcast, I interviewed everybody, and also for the book, I interviewed most of the people in person. And one of the things that I was so astonished by with these two people, and really they can be a model for everybody. You know, I have 8 commandments of what you should not do at Thanksgiving, which I'll tell you in a minute. Get out your pencils and write this all down. But Alan wanted to, he wrote a note to Harry, and he said, Harry, I have an article that I would like you to read about a particular topic that I'm interested in. If I send it to you, would you read it? And then he says the last lines that have never been said before in this country. Of course, I'll read something that you read to send me as well.
Nice.
Never.
He didn't stick it in Harry's face.
Right.
Right. Well, you mentioned being kind of not raising your voice and not trying to, you know, convince the other side that they're wrong. But how do you do that in this era where both sides are almost evangelical in their beliefs that they're right?
Well, what you have to realize, this is the basis, this is the psychological basis of my book. You are not going to change the other person's mind. Right. I don't care how much you think that you were directly told by God what is true. They think the same, or the devil, whoever.
Right.
You are not going to change anybody's mind, no matter how persuasive you are, because people change their minds for reasons of their own, not because you want to force them to. And once you have a discussion that begins with that knowledge, you have a discussion, not a fight.
Right.
And this is something that took me about 10 years of marriage to learn. I was a very slow learner because, of course, I change people's minds for a living. That's what I do, right? Of course, they come to me wanting their minds changed, which is different. Rick did not want his mind changed, right? But of course, I felt I was right.
Did he ever try to change your mind?
Never.
Smart man.
Not once.
Very smart man.
First of all, because, yeah, he was. But also because he had a whole community of colleagues who agreed with him, and he didn't need to, you know, he didn't need me to agree with him. I had never really known anybody who severely disagreed with me. And little did I know that William F. Buckley was going to come to dinner at my house, you know, and that these people who, you know, really don't agree with me about anything became my friends and people who supported me when I was ill and when Rick was ill. And I feel very lucky that I've had these experiences.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, an experience, Michael's with us here, and he is going to experience this week running Thanksgiving dinner for the first time. He's in charge.
Oh, my goodness.
Michael, any questions, any particular worries about the family gathering?
No, but I'm looking forward to the 8 rules.
Yeah. He's got his pen out, Jeannie. Why don't you give us some of your 8 rules?
Yes, I will. I absolutely will. By the way, one thing that he should know is that last year, people made their Thanksgiving dinners 1 hour shorter because they were worried about political fights.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that tragic?
That is sad. Really
third
sad.
Glass of ouzo kicks in. Right?
I just think it's unbelievable. I mean, you can't, for a couple of hours, and I'll tell you one funny thing. I was on a show that they asked several psychologists to talk about it, and the other psychologist said, well, you know, if you're at a party and a lot of people disagree with you, bring a friend who agrees with you. And, you know, and that'll help. And I said, in other words, you want to use your friend as a service animal? Mm-hmm. You can't talk to people on the other side.
Nice.
Somebody helping you. Anyway, you want my 8 rules?
8 rules.
Okay.
Yes.
And we've got about 2 minutes of your time. We've got 2 minutes of your time.
It'll be fast.
Okay, go.
Okay, the 8 rules. Let me find them. I gotta find them.
We're not committed
okay.
to
Well, one of the most important ones while I'm looking here is do not drink and discuss politics. Mm.
That's never.
This is very, very important.
Well, that's the not drinking part is not going to happen at Thanksgiving. So we've eliminated
first of all,
politics.
Don't raise your voice.
Right.
That's something that many, many people told me because everybody will interpret this as shouting and you won't have a rational dialogue.
Right. Yep.
Right.
People now, think also, this is the same thing. If you drink, you will also shout, which is why it's hard enough to have a political talk when you're stone cold sober.
That's true.
And the only people that I interviewed who actually broke stuff had been drinking.
Mm. Wow.
Now, here's another one. I have this is a name that I gave for it, but I bet you'll all recognize it. No article thrusting. Can you imagine what article thrusting is?
Yes,
you take
this
article and you stick it in the other person's face and say, read this. This will tell you what you should think.
Mm-hmm. I have known people who have come to Thanksgiving dinner with a printed copies of articles in their hands. Oh, multiple copies.
Yes,
and hand them out.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Tell them that they have to leave them at the door or else they're not allowed to eat.
Right.
This is very important. Do not start any conversation with the words, how could you possibly think?
Yeah.
You've already turned the person off.
Yeah.
You know, that's Thanksgiving is not the time for this. No place is the time for this, but definitely not the table.
Yeah.
If do not have any fights on social media.
Mm, good call.
Do not unfriend your father, your mother, your brother, or your sister over the Kavanaugh confirmation. Do not break an engagement over the Kavanaugh confirmation. Oh. I'm telling you, these are things that happen.
Right.
All these poor people.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
But the thing that I want people most to remember, well, two things. One is that you cannot change another person's mind and don't try. Mm-hmm. And the other is that if you come with a partner, somebody you love, a friend, to a Thanksgiving dinner and people start ganging up on them because most people agree with you and not them, you must defend them.
Mm-hmm.
It is your moral duty.
You call this the attack dog mode when it's okay to go into attack dog mode, right? I love that.
No, you can't. You've got to stop people. You have to say, this is not the place.
Right.
I did this. I've done this with my husband many times because his friends are much nicer, so they don't attack him than me.
You mentioned
conservatives are much better behaved in this way, at least in my experience. But somebody called Rick a crypto-Nazi.
Oh.
Ooh.
And he laughed it off. And I said, I want you to apologize right now.
Yeah.
Good for you.
This is a serious thing to say to somebody.
Yeah.
And I don't want it said.
Yeah. You mentioned the chemotherapy test.
Yes. Yes. This is a test that Rick and I have made up. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's got a funny name, but it's based on reality. And that is, we've both had cancer at different times in our lives. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we found out is that when you're lying in that bed getting chemotherapy, you do not ask the political registration or the party membership of the person standing next to you getting you through it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a core value.
Yeah.
That's what counts. I don't care, Republican, Democrat, you know, right to life, I don't care.
Yeah.
If somebody stands by you when you need them, that's somebody who's worthy of your love and respect.
Right.
And my other thing that I want to say about that is, you know, if Ginsburg and Scalia could do it, why can't we?
Right.
Good point.
Good point.
Really good point. Yes. Highest court in the land. And pretty big friends. Issues, and they could do it.
Yeah.
All right.
Yes.
Dr. Jeannie Savior,
and
this
it's an inspiration for all of us.
Yeah.
Totally. And you have been an inspiration to us. Thank you so much. The book is fabulous.
Thank you.
There is still time for people to get a copy of I Love You, But I Hate Your Politics before Thanksgiving.
Oh, absolutely.
We'll drop
absolutely.
Off a few copies at Michael's house.
And they can also contact me if they have some questions that they, you know, about political conversations and how to have them. I have lots of people that I talk to, and a lot of them change just by talking about it.
Yeah, that's
true.
I
was really surprised.
No, it works. Well, thank you.
And how many people... You learned something.
Thank you so much and have a great Thanksgiving, okay?
Delighted to be with
Take
you.
Take care.
Good night.
Bye. Bye-bye. Okay, Jeannie Safer notwithstanding, there's a lot of family dysfunction this week.
Oh, yeah.
So my deserted island request, you can make this up. I didn't give you any homework, Nevin, but you can make this up if you think of something, was Thanks. Books about family dysfunction.
Oh, wow.
Now, my go-to is usually King Lear. I realize it's a play, but that's usually my go-to because that's my family. King Lear crossed with 23andMe. But there is this wonderful book. It's called The Return. Have you guys ever heard of this?
Mm-hmm.
It's a few years old, and I always mispronounce the name. The author's name is Hisham Matar, M-A-T-A-R. Mm-hmm. And it's this really interesting, it seems quasi-true story about a young guy who loses his father and goes off looking for him. And there's tons of dysfunction in it. But there's kind of a happy, aspirational, hopeful ending, which for King Lear crossed with 23andMe, I'm hopeful for. I'm hoping that I was adopted, Nevin. It's a long story.
Wow. Okay. I didn't know this was all a therapy session.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, it's totally a therapy session. Totally. David?
Oh. Well,
family dysfunction
so many,
book?
There's so many.
There are so many. When you
so many.
Just Google it, and it just goes on for days.
Just Henry Fonda's biography alone is just like, wow. Yeah. This actually happened to people? Wow. Well, I think I've mentioned this before on an earlier show, one of your 44 other shows, as I'm keeping count. But my favorite, I shouldn't say favorite, one of the books that I always remembered about family dysfunction was The Hotel New Hampshire by John Irving, which is
I don't think you have talked about it.
No, it's, well, he wrote The World According to Garp, of course, and The Hotel New Hampshire is, it's about a family that's really twisted. And a brother and sister who love each other. And they really love each other, and that's all I'm going to say. But it's all about this awful, these awful things that happened to this family that run this hotel.
Unhappy ending?
It's unhappy in the sense that some really bad stuff happens toward the end. But it ends, and then you are somewhat hopeful that they get through, that they can recover from what's happened to them.
There we go. Michael?
Did you change my question? You always change my question.
Yeah.
And the question that I turned back to you is, what do we mean by family? Are we talking about families we choose, sort of traditional nuclear families that we're thinking of?
Good point. Good qualification.
I think I briefly mentioned a graphic novel, and the graphic novel is Blankets by Craig Thompson.
Blankets was fantastic.
So for me, this is, you're looking at, it's a coming-of-age story as a young person is struggling with his family, with some abuse in his past. And so for me, I'm actually looking at the family of, what does it mean if we're brought up in a very religiously strict household? He has evangelical Christian parents, and I'm looking at the family that we sort of choose ourselves as we get older, which has to do with faith and how that might relate to your nuclear family and your relationships within both of those. It's really a starkly drawn book, and I just felt like this time of year, it's getting darker earlier, and there's just something just very powerful about this one.
Nice. I like that one. You can always reframe my questions. Yeah. Evan, anything pop to mind?
I would just say the collected works of David Sedaris. His upbringing and his family.
How could it be? They've got to be the funniest family in America. He and Amy Sedaris, they're hysterical.
And also the saddest.
Yes, very sad, but very funny.
Also some really sad elements to his family story with his mother and his sister both passing. But, I mean, you know, when he comes to just skewering his family, especially around the holidays.
What a great memory of all those family stories when you read them.
Oh, my God. Yeah, no, I mean, like, you're like, I'm so glad that I didn't grow up in this family, but I'm so glad that I have insight into them, because it definitely sounds like a hell that was turned into great comedic material rather than something that was great that also had a comedic underbelly.
Excellent one. Yeah. Okay, close us out. What's one piece of advice for Michael to get him ready for Thursday?
Well, I mean, you've already said you don't do timelines, you don't do shopping lists. I would just say...
So he's screwed, right?
No, I would just say the one thing that I always tell people is don't forget to carve out some time for yourself on the day of, you know, whether that means just to take a shower and have a glass of bourbon on your own. The chef should always take some time to just be calm for a minute, even if it is just a minute or two.
We'll leave the back door unlocked, Michael, if you need to just escape for an hour or so.
So about that smell. Just swing by.
That's the title of the show. Not that smell. Yeah. All right. This has been great. I am very, very thankful for so many people, including everybody at this table, Jeannie McManus, who is not here, Tony, because if it weren't for him, the show wouldn't exist at all. Claude, thank you for making everything happen, my friend.
Thank you.
Nevin, thank you for being here.
Such a pleasure. Thanks,
David,
guys, for having
Michael,
me.
Good luck this week. Man, it's really FaceTime Live, baby.
Just going to go
FaceTime Live. Come back next week. We have got Gene Weingarten from the Washington Post, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner.
Yeah.
We've had a few Pulitzer Prize winners, but he's a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. And I don't know, David or Michael, if you guys have even heard about this book that he's got. Mm-hmm. It's pretty remarkable. It's called One Day, The Extraordinary Story of an Ordinary 24 Hours in America. And he picked one day, and he tells the stories, real stories, of people and what was happening to them on that day. Yeah. It's just remarkable.
Sets you up for the sequel.
Yeah, his storytelling is just phenomenal. And I think somewhere in my emails exchange with him, getting him on the show, he said he once edited Tony Kornheiser.
Yes.
So that could be half the show.
That is.
Thanks, everybody. Happy Thanksgiving.